She was more than a rebel. She was a storm in bare feet. Queen Nanny of the Maroons led warriors through mist-drenched mountains, caught bullets with her hands, or so the British believed, and carved a sovereign nation from the jaws of slavery. No portrait survives, yet her face is everywhere. They tried to erase her. She became a myth. They tried to contain her. She became a spirit. This is not just the story of Jamaica's only national heroine. This is the story of a woman who turned memory into fire, and fire into freedom. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Nanny of the Maroons, A Journey Through Time, Episode 3. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 9, Betrayal and Bloodshed. Betrayal does not arrive with a shout. It comes as a whisper, a glance, a hesitation in the middle of a war chant. It wears a familiar face, speaks with the rhythm of a friend, and hides its blade until you are reaching for its hand. In the quiet before dawn, while the forest still slept and the fog curled between tree roots like breath, betrayal came to Nanny, not from her enemies, but from within her own fire. This chapter of the war would not be fought in battlefields alone. This one would carve through trust. This one would bleed through memory. It began subtly. At first, it was just a feeling, a chill in the air that didn't belong. Nanny, whose spirit was tied to the very pulse of the mountains, began to sense something shifting, not in the sky, but in the eyes of her own warriors. Some wouldn't meet her gaze. Others spoke in half-truths, avoided direct answers. Supplies went missing. Scouts returned with conflicting reports. Her deepest warriors, the ones she had trained from youth, grew nervous in her presence. Something was cracking. And then came a name, Esh, a young warrior, clever and fast, known for his mimicry and sharp eyes. Nanny had once trusted him with messages, had watched him dance during rituals with such conviction she thought the ancestors were speaking through his limbs. But now, something in him had shifted. He was no longer dancing. He was listening too closely, vanishing too long. One night, after the council fire had dwindled and the younger warriors had retreated to their shelters, Nanny called Eshuter. She did not raise her voice. She simply asked, "Who are you speaking with when the trees grow quiet?" He flinched, just barely, but it was enough. "I speak with no one," he said. "That," she answered, "is the most dangerous answer." She dismissed him. And that same night, three Maroon outposts were attacked simultaneously by British troops. Perfectly timed, perfectly mapped. Impossible, unless someone had drawn the maps for them. The losses were staggering. Warriors caught mid-sleep, ambushed by torchlight. Women and children forced to flee into the dark with nothing but their breath. One hut set ablaze with six elders inside, one of whom had taught Nanny her first prayer. The screams tore through the mountain like blades through skin. Nanny stood in the ashes the next morning, barefoot, eyes rimmed with smoke and fury. She held the scorched shell of a charm bag in her hand, one she had given to the elder, who now lay in dust. She did not cry. She remembered, and she prepared. Eshu did not return the next day, nor the next. By the time his name was found carved into a tree, alongside a crudely drawn British crest, no one questioned the truth. The traitor had defected deliberately. He had walked into British camps and exchanged secrets for promises. A seat of power, perhaps a share of land, perhaps just to feel important. But what he truly bought was blood. The Maroon camps were now in a state of emergency. Nanny Town was cloaked in silence. The children stopped laughing. The warriors sharpened blades without singing. Even the birds, it seemed, flew quieter. Nanny called her corps commanders together, those who had bled with her, starved with her, fought beside her in the rain and heat. Together, they sat in the dirt, forming a circle around a fire that burned low and blue. "We have lost our shadows," she said softly. "We must learn to walk in fire." Her plan was not one of revenge. It was restoration. She dispatched silent scouts, women who could move through brush without bending a leaf, men whose footsteps blended with the heartbeat of the earth. She sent them not just for information, but for truth, for the hidden hands, for the whispered names. She uncovered a web. Eshoo was not alone. There were others, some within the Leeward Maroons, some caught between fear and hunger, some simply tired of endless war. They had been lured by British gold, land, false promises of peace, dreams of comfort whispered by men in red coats who had never known a day without privilege. These traitors became guides, brokers, informants. Nanny did not respond with rash violence. She responded with ritual. She called for the Ashanti rites of truth, rituals older than the slave ships, ceremonies performed only when the spirit of a people was fractured. For 3 days, she fasted. No food, no water, only fire and chant. Her warriors followed. They sang until their voices bled. They burned herbs that made the air thick with memory. They danced barefoot on ash. And at the end of it, she made a vow. To the ancestors, she said, raising her hands to the sky, I swear, the traitor's path shall become his grave. Word came soon after. Eshoo had been seen in a British-controlled outpost, leading a band of mercenaries, laughing, eating, wearing cloth stitched with British gold, describing the mountains in exacting detail, telling them Nanny's rhythms, her sacred groves, her methods of calling spirits. He had not just betrayed the Maroons. He had desecrated them. That night, Nanny summoned only 4 warriors. Each had lost a blood relative to the ambushes. Each had been raised by her hands. They did not speak. They vanished into the trees. 3 days later, Esh's body was found at the edge of a British plantation. Eyes closed, tongue cut out, heart removed. His limbs were arranged in the symbol of the Maroon Rebellion. The British were shaken. They increased their patrols. But something had shifted. The betrayal had been punished. And the mountains were no longer silent. Still, the scars remained. Nanny knew that betrayal leaves more than corpses. It leaves cracks. Trust now came with hesitation. Every command she gave was met with double checks, quiet side glances, questions buried in silence. But she did not flinch. She turned instead to the next generation, the children. She began training them personally, teaching not only how to fight, but how to remember. She taught them about Eshoo, not as a demon, but as a lesson. She did not erase the shame. She transformed it into warning. Memory, she told them, is what makes us free. Forgetting is what makes us slaves again. Her leadership, tested by war and treachery, grew sharper. She no longer waited for betrayal to come. She listened for it. She sniffed it out like smoke before flame. She built new codes of communication, harder to decipher. Changed the structure of camps weekly. Kept messages rotating between runners. No one person knew every trail. Every warrior was taught how to become a village, if alone. The Maroons evolved. And though they had bled, they did not break. In private, though Nanny mourned, she sat by herself at the roots of a silk cotton tree, her back straight, her eyes closed. She lit a single candle made from beeswax and memory. There, in silence, she spoke to the ancestors. I am tired, she confessed, but I will not stop. She reached into the soil, pressed her fingers into the dirt. I plant them here, she whispered. The traitors, the fallen, the lost. May their lessons rise like yams in the season of storms. And she rose, barefoot, unbowed, still burning. Chapter 10, Treaty Talks and the Price of Peace. Peace is not always a sunrise. Sometimes it is a dagger wrapped in silk, a poisoned fruit dressed in honey. And for the Maroons, after years of smoke, fire, blood, and betrayal, peace arrived not as a celebration, but as a test of the soul. The war drums had softened, but they had not stopped. The British, wounded but not broken, were rethinking their strategy. And deep within the hills of Jamaica, Queen Nanny, still cloaked in the scent of sacrifice, stood at the edge of a decision that would shape the fate of her people for generations. The year was 1739. For decades, the Maroons had fought the most powerful empire on Earth to a standstill. Without ships, without cannons, without wealth, only spirit, earth, fire, and will. And they had survived. More than that, they had triumphed. The British could not claim their land. They could not control their movements. They could not kill their spirit. But war had its cost. The dead were many. The young had grown up without childhoods. The elders carried wounds that would never heal. Villages had been built, burned, rebuilt, and burned again. Food was sometimes scarce. Sleep came in fragments. Families had been separated for years. And though the Maroons had earned their freedom in blood, the British still held power in numbers, resources, and reach. The weight of war had begun to press heavy on every side. Even Nanny, iron-willed, lion-hearted, could feel the weight. The British began to send envoys. Carefully, cautiously, white men dressed not in red coats, but in muted colors, unarmed, speaking softly, flanked by local intermediaries, men of mixed heritage, or former enslaved Africans now working for the crown, offering olive branches lined with unspoken consequences. The message was always the same. Let us talk. They promised land recognition, autonomy, gifts, truce. And in return, they asked for two things, an end to raids and the return of all future runaway slaves. It was this second request that turned Nanny's stomach. To some of the Maroon leaders, especially those in the West, like Cudjoe, the offer was worth considering. Exhaustion had set in. They had already secured victories that seemed impossible just decades before. Why not turn that into a permanent settlement? To survive, Cudjoe told a gathering of his own people, we must plant roots in the ground. Not just yams. Peace. And in 1739, he signed the treaty with the British. It was a momentous moment. The crown formally recognized the sovereignty of the Leeward Maroons, an unprecedented act by any colonial power. But it came at a price. The treaty required Maroons to aid the British in capturing future runaway slaves. It turned the once revolutionary warriors into a border patrol for the empire that had enslaved them. The ink on the treaty had not yet dried when word reached Nanny, and the mountain grew cold. Nanny did not attend the treaty signing. She refused. Instead, she gathered her council in Moortown, formerly known as New Nannytown, rebuilt after the original had been burned. The circle was smaller now, older, wiser, wounded. What have we gained? She asked quietly. If we must betray the same chains we broke. No one answered at first. Finally, a woman named Amari, one of Nanny's oldest allies, spoke. We are tired, sister. Tired of burying sons. Tired of watching the smoke rise. The children, they dream of silence. Nanny's hands clenched. They will not find silence in the sound of chains. Another elder nodded solemnly. But if we do not bend, we may be broken. Nanny rose. I was born broken, she said, by ship, by whip, by fire. But I rose, not to bend, to build. I will not help them hunt our own, not even for the illusion of peace. The weeks that followed were tense. The British pushed harder. They praised Cudjoe publicly, sent gifts to Moortown, urging Nanny to follow her brother's example. Guns. Fabric, salt, barrels of rum, all wrapped in diplomacy. Nanny sent every gift back, except the salt. She sprinkled it on the ground outside her hut. Let them taste the bitterness of betrayal, she said. Still, the pressure mounted. Food stores were running low after a difficult season. The rains had damaged crops. Raids had stopped, but British patrols remained, testing boundaries. The younger warriors, born after the earliest days of the war, began asking questions. What if we could live without fear? What if peace is what our ancestors want? Nanny heard them all, and she began to visit the rivers again, alone. She walked barefoot, as she always did, to the sacred spring near the edge of the forest, where the water ran clear, and the wind still carried the voice of her mother. There she knelt, pressed her hands to the earth, called out, not in English, not even in the Maroon dialect, but in the old tongue. Ajuin, she whispered. Nana. Tano. Yeah, Asantua. She spoke the names of the spirits, of her ancestors, of the warriors who had never been seen again, of the children buried beneath vines. And then, With salt water in her eyes, she asked the question, "Have I failed them by fighting, or will I fail them by stopping?" No voice answered, only the wind, only the hush of water over stone. But when she opened her eyes, a black feather floated on the surface of the spring. She took it as a sign, and so Nanny made her decision. She would not sign the treaty. She would not return escaped slaves. She would continue to protect Moortown as a sanctuary. But she would also not declare war on Cudjo or the Leeward Maroons. She would not divide her people in blood. She would lead by example, quietly, steadily. If others wanted to chase false peace, she would show them what true freedom looked like. And slowly, they would remember. Years passed. Moortown thrived. It remained hidden, sacred, strong. While Cudjo's settlements, though legally protected, began to suffer under British manipulation, restrictions, encroachments, and quiet erasure. Those who once praised the treaty began to whisper of regret, and more began to look toward the east again, toward Nanny. The British never defeated her. No treaty ever bore her signature. And when future escapees from slavery found their way to her gates, barefoot and starving, she fed them, sheltered them, gave them new names, new life. She broke the treaty in silence, and no one dared stop her. Because by then, even the British knew, Nanny was not a rebel. She was a nation of memory, of defiance, of dignity untouched. And though the price of peace was heavy, she bore it not in submission, but in sovereignty. Chapter 11, The Woman Beyond the Mountain. There are warriors who wield blades. And then there are warriors who carry memory, who become the heartbeat of their people long after the drums of war go silent, who are spoken of not just in history, but in hush, in song, in prayer. After the treaties were signed and the British lowered their guns, the story of Queen Nanny did not end. It evolved. She stepped beyond the mountain and became myth made flesh. In the aftermath of the fighting, the world slowed, but it did not rest. Jamaica had changed. The terrain was the same, lush, brutal, humming with the breath of ancestors. But the political landscape had shifted. The British, though unable to truly conquer the Maroons, now worked through diplomacy and paper, through politics and pressure. Maroon settlements, though technically sovereign, were expected to walk a line of caution and compliance. Cudjo had his treaty. The Western Maroons lived with a kind of protected vulnerability. Land rights, yes, but always under scrutiny. But in the east, in the folds of the Blue Mountains, where the clouds still kissed the treetops, Nanny held something greater than legal papers. She held soul. Moortown had become more than a village. It was a sanctum, a university of the spirit, a temple wrapped in banana leaves and guarded by hummingbirds, a place where the legacy of war became the ritual of remembrance. Here, Nanny was no longer just a general or strategist. She was a mother to a nation. She no longer led raids. She no longer studied British movements. She no longer set traps in bamboo. She had passed that torch to the younger warriors, the ones she had trained, tested, blessed with her own hands. Now, her weapons were rhythm, story, healing. Nanny spent her days walking barefoot through the hills, her body older, slower, but still commanding. She spoke to every child, learned every new name, remembered every death anniversary. She could often be found beneath the calabash trees, whispering chants into hollow gourds, instructing young girls how to speak with their ancestors using smoke and drum. If a child cried in the night from a nightmare, it was Nanny they called. If a marriage was struggling, it was Nanny who performed the ritual binding. If a crop failed, if a snake appeared at a doorstep, if a new warrior needed blessing, it was Nanny who was summoned. One morning, before the sun broke the sky, Nanny walked alone to a hidden spring. There, she washed her face, gathered herbs, sat for hours in silence. She did this every week. When asked why, she answered, "The spirits are like fire. If you do not feed them, they fade." This was not metaphor. To her, the ancestors were present, living forces. She saw them in the rustle of trees, in the swirl of smoke, in the cries of newborns. She never spoke of death as an ending, only as crossing, only as a doorway. In her worldview, her mother still spoke. Her sister still watched. Her people, those lost to the sea, to the ship, to the whip, they walked beside her. Always. She revived rituals nearly lost during the crossing from Africa. The Yam Festival, once banned by the British, was reborn under her guidance. The drum circles, once silenced by slavery, thundered again in the moonlight. She taught the women how to mark time by moon cycles, how to use herbs not just for medicine, but for cleansing, for clarity, for communion with the dead. She reintroduced naming ceremonies that honored both African and Maroon lineage. Children were no longer named for the day they were born. They were named for the spirit they carried, as seen by the elders in vision. She believed the future could not be built until the past was resurrected. Visitors began to come, not just from other Maroon villages, but from enslaved people still living on plantations. Those who had heard stories whispered in cane fields of a woman in the mountains who healed with her hands and made bullets turn back on the men who fired them. They climbed barefoot up treacherous paths. They brought wounds, scars, questions, and she received them all. She never turned anyone away. Some she fed, some she bathed, some she instructed, some she simply held, saying nothing, letting her silence speak to the generations of grief buried beneath their bones. British spies still lingered at the edge of Moortown. They were not foolish enough to enter. They watched. They took notes. They tried to decipher how the settlement, even with no formal agreement, continued to thrive. But what they could not understand was this. Nanny's power no longer needed war to be dangerous. Her very presence was defiance. Her breath was memory. Her rituals were revolution wrapped in incense. And though they tried to erase her with silence, with paper, with misdirection, they failed. Because the people would not forget, and neither would the land. There is a story that sometime in her later years, Nanny was visited by a British official, one who claimed he came in peace, that he wanted to document native customs for the record. He came with a notepad and an interpreter. She listened, smiled. Then she took the notepad, dropped it in the fire, and said, "Write this in your bones, not in your books." The man fled. His name was never recorded. But the story was, as she aged, her physical strength waned, but her spiritual power deepened. Some say she could heal fevers by whispering into a bowl of water, that she could speak with the unborn and tell mothers what name their child would answer to in the afterlife, that she could light fire with her breath. But those who knew her best said her power came from something simpler. She listened, deeply, without interruption. She listened to stories no one else had time for. She listened to the dreams people were too afraid to speak. She listened when the wind shifted and birds changed direction and a child began to sing a song they had never been taught. And through her listening, she remembered everything. Eventually, she stopped walking. Her bones ached. Her voice grew quieter. But her eyes still held fire. She was carried to the gatherings, sat upon mats made from woven banana leaves. Children still circled her knees, eyes wide, hearts open. They called her Nanny the Eternal. One day, without warning, she gathered her closest circle, the oldest warriors, the last of the first, the ones who had survived every fire with her. "I am not leaving," she said, "only crossing." She asked to be buried not in a grave, but in the roots of the mountain. "Let the hills keep my breath," she said. "Let the soil teach my name." No one cried. They just listened. And when she finally closed her eyes, it was as if the mountain exhaled. Birds sang in strange harmony. The mist curled tighter. The air thickened with something holy. To this day, no one knows the exact place where her body rests. Some say she became part of the forest. Others say she disappeared completely, walking into the trees one final time and dissolving into spirit. But in Moortown, and across every ridge of the Blue Mountains, one thing is certain. She never left, because the woman beyond the mountain was never just one woman. She was all of them. The enslaved who ran, the mothers who wailed, the daughters who sharpened blades, the warriors who never came home. She was legacy. She was proof. she was Freedom made flesh, and then flame. Chapter 12, The Last Ritual. There comes a time when even the fiercest flame chooses to become smoke, not to vanish, but to rise. When a body, tired and worn from battles, fought on both earth and in spirit, returns to the soil that raised it. This was not death. This was ascension. For Queen Nanny, the final chapter of her earthly life was not written in silence, but in ceremony, in vibration, in chant, in the sacred rhythm of footsteps, fire, and farewell. She did not go like other leaders. There was no deathbed, no gasping for breath. There was only ritual. And in this, her people understood what the British never could. Nanny had never belonged to this world alone. It began with the dreams. The elders saw her walking through fields of yam that glowed in moonlight, her hands brushing the tops gently, her head turned skyward. The children woke crying, saying they heard Mama Nanny's song in the wind, even though she had not sung aloud for days. And the drummers, those trained to listen for shifts in the rhythm of the land, found their hands slowing without reason, their beats wandering into funeral cadence. Even the forest knew. Birds began nesting closer to the village. The bamboo grove, once tight and guarded, opened slightly to reveal a path no one had seen before. And the mist came early, curling in at dusk and lingering long after dawn. Nanny herself said nothing, but her silence had always spoken louder than most men's speeches. She moved less, ate little, slept often, and when she woke, she would look into the distance with eyes that saw far beyond the horizon. Sometimes she would whisper to herself in Ashanti, sometimes in tongues even her closest allies did not recognize. Her hands, once calloused from machete and drum, now shook softly when raised in blessing. But her power had not faded. If anything, it had shifted. One night, she asked to be bathed. This, in Maroon tradition, was no small thing. To bathe an elder, especially one of Nanny's stature, was to prepare them for the journey across the veil. It was a sacred trust, one carried by the most trusted women of the village, Amari, Tenda, and Loma. Each of them had followed her into battle. Now, they would guide her into memory. They heated the water with herbs, lemongrass for clarity, turmeric for strength, and lavender to invite the ancestors. They sang as they poured the water over her, low, steady tones that resonated deep in the chest. Nanny did not speak. She only closed her eyes and whispered thanks. The next morning, she called for the mat of roots, a ceremonial mat woven from the fibers of five sacred trees, each symbolizing a different element: strength, endurance, memory, wisdom, and passage. She sat upon it for hours, speaking with no one. Warriors stood nearby, just in case. But even the most battle-hardened among them felt no threat, only awe. She was preparing, not to die, but to transition. She asked that the young girls of the village be brought to her, all of them. And so they came, barefoot, wide-eyed, carrying gifts, dried herbs, beads, feathers, stones from their favorite rivers. They sat around her in a circle as she began to speak. "You are not mine," she told them. "You belong to no man, no tribe, no British king. You belong to the breath." She touched her chest. "This fire? It is not mine to keep. I pass it to you." She raised her hand, slowly and with trembling fingers, anointed each forehead with ash and river water. "Remember," she said to each one, and they would nod, trying not to cry. Later that day, she asked for the Bowl of Echoes. It was a sacred vessel, passed down for generations, made from the gourd of a tree that had grown on the graves of enslaved ancestors. It was believed to hold the memory of all who drank from it. She filled it with river water and added a single drop of her blood. Then she drank and sang. The song had no words, only sound, a vibration so ancient that even the trees seemed to lean in to listen. That night, the village gathered, not in mourning, but in honor. No black cloth, no wailing. Instead, drumming, fire, dancing. This was the rite of crossing, a celebration of a spirit returning to its divine form. Nanny sat at the center, her face lit by firelight, her body wrapped in the red cloth of her childhood, a color of blood, yes, but also of life, of root, of resistance. As the dancers circled her, she raised her arms one last time and spoke. "I have walked from Africa to here," she said. "I have walked through water, through fire, through screams and silence. I have walked barefoot on stone, and still I stand. But now, I walk beyond." The drumming stopped. Silence fell, and then wind. A soft gust, unnatural, spiraling through the center of the circle. The fire bent, as if bowing, and Nanny closed her eyes. She did not fall. She did not fade. She simply ceased to be present. When they touched her skin, it was warm. When they laid her on the mat, her hands were folded. There was no struggle, no pain, only peace. But no one would dare say she had died. Instead, they said, she crossed. And from that night onward, Moortown was never the same. Her body was buried not in a grave, but in the hollow of whispers, a hidden place beneath the roots of the mountain where only the highest spirits rest. No stone marked the site, no monument, only the rustling of trees and the scent of burning sage. And yet, her presence remained. The wind still carried her song. The fires burned longer. The rivers ran clearer. Children dreamed of her face. And warriors still whispered her name before going into battle. To this day, the people of Moortown say that if you sit beneath the oldest tree just before sunrise, you may hear her humming. If you close your eyes and place your hand on the earth, you may feel her heartbeat. And if you are lost, truly lost, and you call her name with honesty and pain in your chest, she may come to you, not as a vision, but as courage, as memory, as the fire inside your own ribs. Nanny's last ritual was not an ending. It was an instruction, a map, a path carved by feet that refused to bow. And long after the British left, long after Jamaica changed flags, long after books began to misremember her, her spirit remained exactly where it had always been, between root and sky, watching, guiding, enduring,